The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I work here in the author events office, and I'm very excited to be here tonight to introduce Professor Brian Kaplan. Dubbed the anti-tiger mom, I love that, by the Wall Street Journal, contrarian economist Brian Kaplan is the author of the, quote, wickedly subversive parenting manifesto, Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, which argues that parenting has needlessly been turned into a tedious chore. He's also the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, which questions fundamental assumptions about why Americans vote as they do. A professor of economics at George Mason University, a blogger for EconLog, and a contributor to a slew of publications, including the New York Times, The Atlantic, and the American Economic Review, he is currently collaborating on a nonfiction graphic novel about the social science and philosophy of immigration, and is also working on a book titled Poverty, Who to Blame. Mr. Kaplan's latest completed book is the explanatorily and wonderfully bluntly titled The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. In it, he argues that we need to stop wasting public money on education, explains why college degrees are little more than conformity signals meant to certify students as potential lockstep employees, and advocates for major policy changes at all levels of the academy. For this work, he has been praised as an idiosyncratic genius and the foremost whistleblower in the academy. Here to tell us more about it, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Brian Kaplan.
So thank you very much for that kind introduction right there. Why don't we just get started? All right, let me just start with the normal view of education. This is what you have probably been hearing from a very young age, maybe what you've been telling your kids, what you've been hearing teachers tell you. And it just says this: we should have more and better education. Who could be against it? Who would run for office saying anything else? Can you imagine someone running for office saying we need to have less and worse education? Right, that would seem like a direct ticket to defeat. Now, I am an economist, and a lot of my work is about ways in which economists and non-economists say different things. This is actually an area where there's a great meeting of the minds, and non-economists and economists basically think the same thing. We're not investing enough. We need to invest more. Right? Now, when economists go and try to measure what exactly is the payoff for education, and what if we go and think about education as being like any other investment? What if you think about it as being a 401k? The normal conclusion is it's actually got a really good return, right? And for many economists, then they assume this shows that education builds human capital, which they mean it pours skill into students, and that's why it actually leads to so much extra earnings, right? But this brings us to the big puzzle. How many people here have ever actually been in school at any point in your lives? Yes, all right. So you've experienced education. Now, when in experiencing education, have you noticed that a lot of your classes don't teach any job skills at all? Right, so yeah, I noticed that a lot. And you know, I was getting a PhD in economics. There's a lot of stuff I learned in my PhD program that I don't even use on the job. And then for all of the other classes, foreign language classes or history classes or Shakespeare, like, how often does this even come up in my job as a professor? Never mind the jobs that people do where it's much more about what they learn on the job. So this seems pretty weird, saying, like, what fraction of U.S. jobs ever use knowledge of history? All right, so, again, so a history teacher, history professor, freelance writer of history books, a few other jobs, but most people who learn history in school never wind up using it on the job. Which, if you see how little history people actually remember, is probably a good thing because people forget almost everything they are taught. Or how about higher mathematics? Yeah, I had a Russian colleague when I was saying, you know, Ilya, most people don't actually use calculus on the job. And he's like, how can this be? Calculus is very useful. And I said, no, like, what are these jobs that do not use calculus? Like, well, name almost any job and hardly probably doesn't use calculus. Right? And then, you know, music, art. These are classes which are very common. So I remember when my kids were in elementary school, they had three different music classes going on at once. And if we were to say, look, they're just not going to do it, so they say, no, it must be done, right? And if you don't do it, we're not going to let you advance to the next level, right? Or Shakespeare, of course. Or, again, in the United States, foreign languages. I know there are countries where foreign languages are very good openers to many different careers, especially if the foreign language is English. But in the United States, how many people learn a foreign language well enough in school to do anything with it in the real world? Right? Very few. Right? In the book, I actually put together all the data we got, and less than 1% of Americans even claim to have learned to speak a foreign language very well in school. Right? People learn to speak foreign languages very well in the home. Right? But in school, even though people do on average 2 years, nevertheless, they take away next to nothing. Right? Or how about Latin? Right, a dead language, which is one which has actually been revived. It's become at least quite a bit more common than it was 20 years ago to learn Latin in school, but when will you ever actually use it? You know, maybe there could be a time machine that takes you back to ancient Rome, but until then, not likely you're going to be using Latin. All right, you might remember going back to your school days, if those are behind you, that often in a classroom, where they're teaching, say, trigonometry, there's a smart aleck in the back of the room saying, what does this have to do with real life? When are we really going to use trigonometry? Right, and the teacher gives a smug look, and you'll see. All right, well, have you seen? All right, when has the trigonometry come up? All right, so like once in a long while, but not very often. All right, now this seems awfully strange. It'd be one thing if teachers went and taught stuff that was not important, and then employers said, "I don't care about school because you just learned a bunch of stuff that isn't important." But that's not how the real world works. The way the real world works is this: you learn a bunch of stuff where it doesn't seem like it's really relevant on the job. And then, when you go looking for a job, employers heavily favor people who have done well in school. They heavily favor people who have at least finished college, heavily favor people who have a degree from a fancy school, right? And this seems very odd. So why would you pay a large premium? Why you pay a lot extra in order to get a worker who has studied subjects that they're never going to use on the job? I mean, this seems like a great way to save money. Well, you know what? From now on, I'm just going to hire people right out of high school, and I'm going to pay them a lot less. And since what they learn in college is not actually useful here at our paper mill, then I'm just going to get workers that are just as good for less money. It sounds like a pretty good deal. All right. Now, here is the explanation that I push heavily in the book, the signaling explanation, which is makes it easy to explain all of these facts and much more, as we're going to see. Easy to explain it using what is called the signaling model of education. The main idea, yes, though some schooling does raise productivity, and I never want to give the impression that I'm unaware that reading and writing and math are taught in school. I know that. I did learn some reading and writing and math in school. I'm aware of that. I'm aware that those are useful job skills. I'm aware that there are some other things that people learn in school that occasionally they'll use in the job, say engineering courses or CS courses. Right, so I am aware of this. I know all about this. I did go to regular school. I was in there for 17 years, and then I've been a professor for 20 years plus. All right, so I do know that there is some schooling where the normal story applies, and it's like, well, yeah, he makes more money because he knows how to read, and he learned how to read in school, and he may be able to read, and it's better to have a worker who knows how to read. End of story. All right, but that's not puzzling. It doesn't require any big explanation. But if we want to explain all the other stuff, all the time that you were sitting there going, why do I have to study this stuff? I'm not interested, it's never going to come up again. And yet, if I don't do it, if I stonewall and say, look, I'm just not going to learn a foreign language until you convince me I'm going to need to know it. Right? And what happens to you is you don't get into college, and then your options are greatly, greatly reduced. So what's going on there? Well, the signaling story says that while there is, of course, the regular, plain vanilla, productivity-raising kind of school, there's also a lot of education that is hoop jumping, jumping through hoops to impress employers. You're doing it to show off or to signal a lot of different traits. So it could be your IQ, could be your work ethic, could be your conformity, right? So all these things together, really, you're showing I've got a package of traits that allows me to be academically successful. Right now, you probably know a friend who is really great on one or two of these, but has very little education. Yeah, so I have a friend who dropped out of multiple things, and he was very smart, very hardworking on anything that he applied himself to, but he was ultra-defiant. His conformity was terrible. So whenever he had a job and they tell him what to do, and he's saying, no, I'm not going to do that. And it's like, yeah, wow, you're really smart, and you really work hard when you apply yourself, but you won't work hard on anything we tell you to do, so you're useless to us. And maybe the next time we're not going to give a chance to someone who doesn't have their credentials. All right. So the key assumptions of these models are as follows. First of all, there's got to be some hard-to-observe differences. You can't be able to just look at someone and say, there's a great worker, there's a bad worker. It's got to be something where it takes some effort and where someone might impersonate a good worker. You know, of course, when you go to interview someone and you say, are you a good worker? You know, what's everybody going to say? Oh, yeah, I'm a fantastic worker. Yeah, best you've ever seen. I'm just going to blow you away. Just hire me, and you're going to see how wonderful I am. All right, so of course, since people say that, you cannot actually believe them. So you need to get some way, or anyway, but it's going to be the case that you can't just easily see how good people are, or else there's no reason to have signaling. Secondly, you need these differences in worker quality to correlate with something observable, something that can be easily seen, something like grades or diplomas. So if, on average, people with good grades and fancy diplomas are, in fact, better workers, then it makes sense for employers to go and favor those people, even if it's not always true. Right? You know, I know there are plenty of people who are good workers who don't have fancy credentials, and I also know plenty of people with fancy credentials who are lazy and useless. Right? I've seen plenty of them. But on average, the people, as long as it's true that on average, the people with the better grades and the fancy credentials are better workers, it makes sense for employers to go and use this as a way of sorting people out. Right? And then again, the last key assumption that you need is that higher productivity workers have to have a lower cost, right? Which could be money or time or just pain, of performing this observable activity. If you're smart, it's easy to go and get those fancy credentials. Right? You don't have to work that hard because the material comes to you easily. If you're a hardworking person, the fact that you're expected to go and toil away to study for the final exam for 10 hours does not burden you in the way that it would someone who's lazy. Right? And then finally, if you are a conformist person, you don't mind doing a bunch of stupid stuff just because your professor told you you had to do it. Whereas if you are a free thinker, an independent spirit, people like this are really unhappy in school because you're always being told to do something dumb. You know, I remember when my sons were in high school for a few weeks before I evacuated them, the Spanish teacher, who had never taught any actual Spanish, said, I want everyone to go down to Home Depot and get a big sheet of plywood and then put a flag on it. Right, and that's your assignment, right? And if I were there, I would be thinking, this is the dumbest thing in the world. This has nothing to do with learning Spanish. Why do I have to go and get the plywood? But people who don't mind conforming will say, yes, yes, ma'am, I'll go get my plywood and fix my flag. That's what you say, that's what I'll do. All right, now, in the signaling models, the market rewards people show their stuff even if the display itself is wasteful. So even if you're never going to use Aristotle or a foreign language on the job, just the fact that you did it and did it well makes employers feel like they can trust you. It makes them feel like you are worthy of getting the real training, that on-the-job training where they actually teach you something practical. All right, now, the ubiquity of useless education. Why should we actually believe in signaling? Well, just the strongest reason is just to look at the curricula. Just look at what people actually learn. Remember what you learn. Look at, if you're currently in school, take a look at what's on your schedule. And just think, like, do I really ever need to know this? Was it reasonable to think that I would ever need to know it? Did I, in fact, use it? All right, so in the book, I just, you know, to start off with, like, looking at what do kids in high school in the United States study. So there's good data on this. And we see only about 30% of high school course hours are spent on English and math. All right. On the other end, so we've got 40% on arts, foreign language, history, social studies. And again, so, you know, I am a social scientist. I think this is interesting material, but I'm not going to say that it's a pathway to a lot of jobs other than professional social scientist, which is not, of course, a very common job. Right? We can see similar patterns for U.S. college majors. So only about a little bit less than 25% of graduates have majors that you could at least argue are vocational. Engineering, computer science, agricultural science, things like this, right? And, you know, engineers are about 5% of all college graduates. So whenever people start to say, what about engineers? Yeah, well, like one kid in 20, that's about, you know, so that's okay. All right. In the book, I also go over measured learning. So now there's two ways that you can measure learning. There is a bad way, which is you go and look at what students know on the day of the final exam. Right? The problem with this is that people forget what they learn. And of course, if you want to understand why employers are doing what they're doing, employers don't want to pay you for what you used to be able to do. They want to pay you for what you can do now. So if students actually forget most of what they learn in school, when the time that they're looking for a job, they remember very little of it, then that would be weird. Anyway, so it's easier to get data on kids on the day of the final exam, but what's really relevant is what adults actually have managed to retain. And I do have data on this. So researchers who measure adult literacy, numeracy, and knowledge of civics, history, science, and foreign languages find shockingly low scores. Right? So, you know, like even on basic literacy and numeracy, it is, you know, easily a third of adult Americans know so little. Again, of course, they know, you know, like almost everyone knows their letters, but in terms of just being able to, like you know, understand like a TV guide or medical instructions, things like this. So it's like, wow, like the knowledge is so low. And then these other areas, the knowledge is nearly non-existent. So, like, you know, when you take a look at historical knowledge of adult Americans, you know, a good rule of thumb is they can correctly answer about half of the very most basic questions you can imagine. Right? And to me, this is, you know, a lot like, what if someone knew half the letters in the alphabet? You know, what would you call someone who knew half the letters in the alphabet? You know, illiterate. Right? So, like, they know, you know, about half of the stuff that seems so amazingly basic. You know, like standard one, about half Americans know every state has two senators. Like, how can you not know that? You're taught that so many times, and yet goes in one ear and out the next. All right, which brings us to the handsome rewards of useless education, which is where things get really weird. All right, now the ubiquity of useless education would not be so puzzling if the market rewarded education poorly. So if it really were normal for people to get college degrees and then go and get jobs that they could have gotten right out of high school, that would be strange. Especially since when you ask college students why they're there, the main reason they say they're there today is to get a better job and to make more money. Right, so people sometimes say, you economists, you're so terrible, you think people are there for the money. Yeah, you know who else says they're there for the money? The students. All right. Okay. So anyway, it would not be so weird if the market rewarded education poorly, but it actually rewards it quite well. So at least in the U.S., the U.S. is a country where the rewards for education are especially high, but it is, it is true all over the world. I don't know of a single country where there are not at least pretty good rewards of having fancy degrees. Right, and this remains true after making a whole lot of adjustments. So if you want to talk about the Q&A, I'm happy to, but there's a lot of adjustments that you might want to make to these numbers. For example, maybe it's really the smarter kids that are more likely to get more education, and then maybe they would have made more money anyway. So you can go and make adjustments for all the stuff. And what you'll see is that even after making all these adjustments, the true effect of education is smaller than it superficially looks, but it's still pretty good. Right? So it's nice as signaling it reconciles research on learning with research on earning. Right? You know, these are two different areas, mostly done by two totally different kinds of people. So you have research on learning being done by education researchers and psychologists, research on earning being done mostly by economists, and the signaling model lets us take everything they're finding and snap it all together and say it's actually consistent, even though it seems on the surface like it's not. All right. Now, other than this disconnect between learning and earning, what are some other signs that you might be signaling? All right, so this is with apologies to Jeff Foxworthy. I don't know if anyone remembers him. Does he have a Netflix special anytime recently? All right, so here are some signs that you might be signaling. First, if you bother to enroll or pay tuition, you might be signaling. How so? Well, I don't know of any school where they actually check ID to make sure that no one's learning for free. If you want to just start attending classes anywhere in the world, just move there, show up, and start going. Right? You don't have to enroll, you don't have to apply, and you certainly don't have to pay them anything. Just show up and start attending. If you go to the professor and say, you know, I'm not really a student here, do you mind? In general, professors will get a little tear in their eye. It's like, someone wants to learn what I have to teach. This has never happened before. A glorious day. All right, that's the normal reaction. You don't have to actually pay anything if all that you want is the learning. Right? But there's just a little problem. If you go and get a guerrilla Princeton education, at the end of 4 years, you'll have all that Princeton knowledge, but what will you not have? Yes, the Princeton diploma. No official record you were ever there. Suspicious. Now, I'm not going to say, thought experiment to think about. So if you suppose you could either have the Princeton diploma with no education, or you could have the Princeton education with no diploma. Which one do you want? Well, I'm not going to say this is an easy question, but what I say what's amazing is that you have to think about it at all. Because if you believe the normal view, then you say, well, of course, it's better to have the education and no diploma. But nobody does that. And everyone says, tough call. Well, if you think that's a tough call, then you must believe in signaling to a large degree. All right, another sign you might be signaling. If you worry about failing the final exam but not subsequently forgetting what you learned, what's the difference? Well, if you fail a final exam, the signal you send to the world is that you tried and failed, and you're probably not very good at learning stuff. On the other hand, if you got an A and then forgot it all, what have you signaled? that you're human. You do something that almost every human being does, which is forget material that you don't use for years, year after year. All right. So again, this is weird because if we thought that what was going on in school was you were getting skill poured into you, if it gets poured in and then it falls right out a couple years later, why would employers reward you for it? Doesn't make much sense. But if on the other hand, the employers are just looking to see, well, is this the kind of person that can get an A if they want to? And the kind of person that tries to get an A if they enroll, yes? Well, that sounds like the kind of person that I could successfully teach something to, right? So in terms of what you know about, you know, just think about, you know, like your trigonometry class. How much trigonometry do you still remember? For a lot of people, it's nothing, right? So what's the difference between you and a person who just failed the class? In terms of the amount of trigonometry that you know today, maybe no difference. But in terms of your perceived trainability, big difference. The person that did well in trigonometry years ago, the employer will say, well, if they could learn that, they could probably learn what I want to teach them. And otherwise, I'm nervous. All right. Here's another one. If you don't think the cheating is only cheating yourself. All right. So think about what cheating is if the point of school is just to build up skills. Well, basically that means I'm going to go to school, I'm going to pay all the money, and then I'm going to download some stuff from the internet and not learn anything. And thanks, I paid you a ton of money so that I could copy something from the internet. Like, you know, like if what you're trying to do is get skills, then you would just be cheating yourself. What would be the point? On the other hand, if what you're trying to do is impress employers, then it's easy to see why students want to cheat. Because the employers are never going to actually know whether you learned the material or not. So what do you do by cheating? You impersonate a good student. You fake it. You make yourself look just like the student who's actually good. And when you do this, not only are you ripping off the employer who thinks that he's getting a high-quality worker where he's probably getting a low-quality worker, you're also ripping off your fellow students because you are devaluing their degree. When there are cheaters around and a school has a reputation for having a lot of cheaters, this means that that the honest students are not going to be looked upon as kindly by employers. Well, we know it's a diploma mill, so we're pretty nervous about hiring you given the low reputation of your school. Right, so if you don't think the cheating is only cheating yourself, you are thinking about signaling. Here's another one. If you seek out easy A's, anyone who's ever looked and deliberately chosen a teacher or professor who doesn't ask you to do very much and gives you good grades despite lack of work. This is very odd if you're going to school to have skill poured into you. Why do you go to the person who hardly pours any skill in? But if you're trying to go and impress employers, this makes perfect sense because the employers don't know the difference between the easy trigonometry teacher and the hard trigonometry teacher. They can't tell. Well, an A is an L. You got an A in trigonometry. Was that an easy teacher, hard teacher? I don't know. But so when you go and get the easy teacher, then you are able to blend in. You look like you are a hard worker when in fact and that you learn the material well when in fact you quite possibly didn't. Funny sidebar here. There's a website called RateMyProfessor.com. On this website, they have a rating for easiness, where easiness is more easiness is considered good. They also have you can give your professors tamales to say they're hot. I have no tamales; it's very disappointing. But anyway, but they do not have any rating for usefulness of the material. There's no point where students go and say, "Oh my God, this was stuff that I really needed to learn, and now I apply it all the time." Right? Students don't seem to care. Right, and here's the last one. If you rejoice when teachers cancel class. So there was one time I had offered to go to Singapore, and it meant going and skipping out on a week and a half in school. And I told the students, so I'm going to go to Singapore, and you got two choices. Either we can just work a little bit harder, and then we'll be done early. Or I could, if anyone here in the room will feel cheated, I'll make sure there's a substitute teacher so that you get your full money's worth. Is there a single person here? And I said, look, if there's one person in the room feels he'll be cheated, I'll arrange for the substitute. No one raised their hand, and everyone seemed totally delighted to go and get out of a week and a half of school. Right? Yeah. So, you know, if you thought that the human capital story was right, this would be like you hire some roofers to go and fix your roof, and then they say, you know what? We're going to take your money and not show up today. I'm like, what? Right? And we expect you to be happy about it. Well, I'm not happy. When I go and pay someone to invest in my roof, I want to receive the investment. But when students pay people to invest in their knowledge base, they seem to like it best if they actually don't receive what they're paying for. Weird. Okay, so now what is wrong with signaling, actually? What is actually the problem supposed to be? All right, so you could say, you know, who cares if education builds human capital or just signals it? What possible difference does it make? So selfishly speaking, the real answer is it doesn't much matter. If all you want to do is go to school to get ahead, you don't need to sit around reflecting, well, why? Right? You know, like, well, who cares? All you need to know is if you go to school and you do the work, you get a better job and you make more money, and everything else is purely academic. All right, so that's from the point of view of the individual student, from the selfish point of view. But is there any other point of view? Of course. All right, so who cares if education builds human capital or just signals it? The answer is that signaling implies that education is what economists call negative externalities. Classic example of a negative externality is pollution. You go and drive your car around, it's convenient, but you also are fouling the air. Right? And how many people sit around saying, oh my God, I'm hurting a lot of other people here, maybe I better not drive today because it will bother some other people a little bit, and when you add it all up, it's a problem. You know, a few people might do that, very few. Right? And again, if you were to go to the person driving and say, fool, you're poisoning your own air, the selfish answer is just a little bit, just a smidge. I'd rather not have to walk an hour and have the air be one millionth more poison today. Right? That's, you know, selfishly speaking, that's a good deal for me. All right, so that's a standard example of a negative externality where there are people, where there are side effects on bystanders. And in the signaling model, your education has a bad side effect on bystanders. Namely, when you get more education, you make everybody else look a little bit worse. All right, everyone else looks a little bit inferior by comparison whenever you go and strut your stuff. Okay, so this is a lot like another great example of something with a negative externality, which is standing up at a concert. So, actually, we're all sitting down here. I think, well, a few people in the far back, but imagine some of you wanted to see me better. I don't know why, but suppose you're desperate to see me better. All right, what is a thing that any one individual in this audience could do to see me better? Stand up. All right, therefore, if everyone stands up, everyone sees better, right? Wrong. Not true. If everyone stands up, the main result is that everybody's feet hurt more. Right? And on average, people's views are not going to improve, especially if this were a packed room, then it would be really clear. All right. So in the same way that just because one person stands up at a concert and they see better, it doesn't mean that if everyone stood up, everyone would see better. Similarly, the signaling model says just because one person makes more money when they get more education doesn't mean that everyone makes more money if everyone gets more education. Instead, what's likely to happen is we'll get what's called credential inflation. This is where when there's a lot of people floating around with a lot of degrees, employers raise the bar. And they say, well, now, before I would have thrown away applications for everyone who didn't have a high school diploma, now I'm going to throw away applications for everyone who doesn't have a college diploma. Right? Now, if you are, say, 40 or older, you may even now remember jobs where you used to not need college where now you do need college. Or jobs where before it would be ridiculous to have college and now it's pretty common. Right? So in my book, I go over a bunch of examples of this. So again, jobs where it's now pretty common for people to have college degrees, where it would have been almost unheard of in the past. Waiter, bartender, cashier, taxi driver. In 1945, there were almost no taxi drivers with college degrees. Now it's pretty common. Right? And again, why? Well, the more degrees people around you have, the more it takes for you to go and impress employers, convince them that you are worthy of employment. Which brings us to policy implications. Now, there's a lot of people I know who are with me on everything that I've said, and they're nodding their heads and saying, my God, my education was useless, and yeah, but if I didn't have it, I could never have gotten my job. And then I say the next line, they say, whoa, hold on there. And the line is, yeah, drastically cut education spending. Or sometimes I just cut it a little bit. How about cut it 2%? How about that? And this is where I get a lot of pushback, and people get very upset. And they say, look, just because it's useless and you don't really, and I had to have it in order to get a job, doesn't mean we don't want to have less of it. Like, well, why not? Why not? I'm confused. What exactly is it? Now there are some other arguments that I'm gonna get to in a minute. I say this is the pretty obvious story. If you start off with the view that education is good because it trains people to be turns unskilled workers into skilled workers, that sounds like a pretty good story about it's good to be in a well-educated society. On the other hand, if your story is no, education puts a sticker on people's forehead saying grade A worker, and the more stickers you have, the more you need. That sounds like a society you're like, well, gee, then why do we want to have so much education? Certainly would you want to have more people going to college if the main thing that happens in college is you get a sticker? And if enough people have the stickers, then you need to have a master's degree in order to get the same job. All right, so drastically cutting education spending is one of the main prescriptions. Now, again, people often want to say, look, no. First, tell us a way to make education, we should figure out a way to make education better before, not cut it, improve it. Right? And this is where I'll say, well, cutting is really easy and improving is really hard. Right? And often we don't really have a good idea about how to improve it, or there's ideas that seem to work, but the system has shown so little interest in them that you might be skeptical of the system. Right? So an analogy that I have is, suppose that you are about to go into back surgery, and a friend of yours says, look, I've been reading about this, and the back surgery you're getting, you know, the back problem you have, surgery just makes it worse. At least you're going to, you know, like doesn't make it better. And you say, all right, fine, that's true, but I'm still going to get it unless you tell me a better kind of back surgery to get. And your friend says, like, I don't know any better kind of back surgery to get. But all I can tell you is you are going and getting surgery for nothing right now. He said, well, if you can't tell me something better, I'm just going to stick with the best I've got. The best you got is not doing it. That's better. All right, so similarly, if in fact we've got education spending, which really is wasteful, then saying let's keep doing it until someone comes along with something better seems to me to be a very stubborn attitude. Now, there is one kind of education where I think there is very solid evidence that it is better than what we're doing right now, and this is vocational education. From the point of view of a selfish individual, there's evidence that vocational education, at least a bit more vocational education, will be better than what people are doing now. And especially for kids who just really hate academics, and there's a lot of kids like that, vocational education seems like a better option for them. But especially from a social point of view, what's really great about vocational education is that it does give people useful training. So it's not like standing up at a concert when you learn how to be a plumber or an electrician. All right. Now, last, the humanist critique. Let me just see, where am I on time? Sorry, I can't. Oh, sorry, I'm fine. Okay, great. All right, so the humanist critique. This is what I think is the best reply to all this is, yes, you're right about all this stuff, but still, education is wonderful. And it goes something like this. So there are a lot of critics who will say, sure, signaling explains most of education's economic return, but the problem with you is that you are a narrow-minded, bean-counting economist, and you're forgetting what education is really supposed to be about anyway. It's not about training people for a job. It's not about the money. It's about something else, something much more important than that. All right, so shouldn't education foster students' appreciation for ideas and culture and turn them into better citizens? Right, and especially among philosophers, they said, well, yeah, we never imagined that education was actually preparing people for jobs. Well, what it really does is prepare you to be a decent human being. In fact, you know, it turns a beast into a human being, turns, you know, these animals who cannot appreciate Shakespeare and Wagner, right, and the theory of relativity, and takes them and it fills them with wonder about the great ideas in the world, and that's why education is great. And of course, along the way, they learn to be good citizens. So it enriches their lives, right? So it's a story that I've often heard, right? Now, it is kind of annoying to me when people purport to have read my book and then they say, see, you never even consider this. And I actually have a whole chapter on it. It's a late chapter in the book. But you clearly didn't actually read the book if you're saying that it never occurred to me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I have thought about this. All right. So here's my quick version. I'm actually not a normal bean counting economist. There are a lot of those out there, I don't deny it, and they're pretty boring. But I'm the kind of economist, I love ideas and culture. You know, so I was an undergraduate philosophy major. I read a lot of history. There's so many things in the world that fascinate me. I love German opera. I like Shakespeare. So I enjoy all of these things that the humanists are talking about. Right? Here is my main objection to what they're saying. I say, oh, yes, I personally share these ideals, but actually existing education barely delivers. Actually existing education has almost no effect on students' appreciation of ideas and culture, and it's not turning them into much better citizens than they'd otherwise be. So here's how I go. I say, look, there's three conditions that we need for education to be intrinsically valuable. Right? What does that mean? Well, instrumentally valuable education is when you go and you learn something in order to get a job. All right, so that's instrumentally valuable. It's not that you really like the education, you're not savoring it, you're saying, look, it's a means to an end, I'm doing it instrumentally. Intrinsically is where you go there and say, this is enriching me, this makes me a better person, this is great, I would do this just, even if there were no financial rewards of education. All right, so here are what I think of as minimal conditions for education to have intrinsic worth. First of all, worthy content. You have to be teaching them something that's actually interesting and really does enrich the human experience. The things seem pretty obvious, but like memorizing state capitals, like something a lot of kids have to do. Is that really worthy? Or getting the plywood and putting a flag on it. What's so great about that? Then skillful pedagogy. Having a teacher that's actually good, like Robin Williams and Dead Poets Society. that kind of a teacher, the inspiring teacher, right? The teacher that fills students with wonder and gets them excited about whatever it is they're teaching. So that's another important component of having worthy education. And then last one, eager students. The students actually want to be there. At minimum, they are willing to be convinced. They're there saying, well, maybe this is interesting. Let's hear what the professor has to say. All right. Now, in the book, I go over all the empirical evidence that I can find on this and say that actually existing education is poor by all three standards. All right. Actually existing education just doesn't measure up. All right. So in terms of content, just remember all of the soul-draining busy work you have to do in order to get your education. All the stuff where you say, like, this enriches the soul. Memorizing state capitals enriches the soul. You know, like going and copying railroads on a map, that enriches the soul. Right? Come on. Stuff is terrible. This is the kind of thing that you would do if you wanted to torture someone all day. Like, you're going to sit down, you're going to complete 50 projects like this. Like, oh my God, I really do not want to do this. All right, so, you know, of course, you know, is there some? Sure, there's some. I've had a few good teachers in my time, but so many of them, like, just what they are teaching you is really boring. Have you ever had an economics class where they spend five weeks on alternative ways of calculating GDP? I feel for you. That's not what economics is supposed to be. GDP should be one lecture, all right? We get the gist of it, all right? It's a number that measures production. Great. All right, now tell us something that really matters. All right, now pedagogy. All right, so think about all the boring and uninspiring teachers you've ever had. All right, now I know that there are, of course, you know, there are plenty of great teachers out there, but it's a big country. What is the average teacher like? Well, think about this. Have you ever gone to YouTube and say, I'm going to listen to a teacher of average quality lecture for an hour on something? Does anyone go and voluntarily listen to a teacher of average quality on YouTube? I don't think so. Why? Because a teacher of average quality is boring. All right, now, if they were teaching you something really useful, if they're teaching you reading or math or writing, the fact they're boring is not that important because, look, yeah, he's boring, but he taught me something that I really need to know. But if they're teaching you Shakespeare and they're boring you to tears and you're never going to need to know Shakespeare again, well, then, look, if I don't need to know it again and I'm suffering with boredom, why is this happening? Right, and especially, of course, now when you can go onto the internet and download endless free, high-quality lectures on Shakespeare. Right, so what's the point of going and having people listen to mediocre teachers doing it? Right, and then last, right, so the students, how eager are students? Well, so you guys are here, so you have an eagerness that is way beyond what I can ever expect to get from college students. All right, so here is one of my favorite tests of how eager the students are. Look at their faces. Look at their faces. How happy are the students to be there? Right, and I generally, so my student evaluations are actually really good, but not enough to actually make the students happy, generally, right? You know, I can get some laughs out of them sometimes, but, you know, the students just seem very unhappy. In the book, I quote this line from Steven Pinker, you know, famous Harvard professor, also often repeatedly voted as one of the best professors on Harvard or best teachers at Harvard. And then he looks out at his class and he sees that half the students aren't there. He says, well, how good can I really be if half the students don't even want to listen to me, right? You know, he's like, by many rankings, he's one of the best teachers in the world. His students are supposed to be the best students in the world, and yet half of them don't even bother to show up. All right, so look at the faces, look at attendance, and I think you can see that the students are generally not very eager. All right, now what about citizenship? Again, this is pretty complicated. Education does modestly change students' political views, but we can talk about that in the Q&A if you want. But the mechanism is crucial. Right, is the reason that they go to school and then the professors go and fill their heads with whatever the professors want them to learn. That's one story. That's a story that, of course, thrills some people and scares others. But the fact that it thrills some and scares others doesn't make it true. Right? And what I say in the book, I don't have time to go into the reasoning, is if you really look at the patterns, it seems primarily like college changes students because you learn views from other students. Right? In other words, it's what's called the big sort. You go to college and this socially isolates you. You're physically isolated when you're in college, but also you're socially isolated afterwards because who do college graduates hang out with generally? Other college graduates. Who do they marry? Overwhelmingly, they marry other college graduates. So really what college, you know, it seems like the main way that college actually changes your political views is by segregating you. Right? Now, there's an interesting thing about the segregation, which is that when you do this, if you get segregated into group A, then you become more like group A. But what if you're segregated into group not A? Then you become more like group not A. right? So if college is more secular, then if you go and send a religious kid to college, he's likely to become more secular. But at the same time, you have also siphoned off secular people that might have influenced religious people who don't go to college, right? So it's not at all clear that the overall effect on society is anything. Very much looks like it could be that what happens in college is that college graduates become more like each other, and then people who don't go to college become less like college graduates because they have so little interaction with them. All right, so that's the end of that, and I would be delighted to take your questions now.
Can you tell us what happened with your own children?
Absolutely. Yes, so I've got four kids. So I don't remember, my last book was Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, so only four. So my first two kids just did regular education for K through six, and they were so miserable that I started looking into homeschooling. And I was very concerned, based upon signaling, that the colleges would heavily discriminate against them based upon homeschooling. So, I put a lot of time looking into, how penalized would they be for doing homeschooling instead. And, of course, if you go to, Homeschooling Legal Defense Fund, they'll tell you colleges love homeschoolers. I don't know. I try to track down neutral researchers, and their main the main thing is, look, probably in the past, colleges did discriminate against homeschoolers quite a bit, but there's so many of them now that it's actually pretty safe to do it. And so I said, okay, now that seems pretty good. So I have been homeschooling my older two kids. My wife wanted them to go back to regular high school for high school. So they did that for 3 weeks, and they just hated it so much, and they were learning so little that we decided to resume homeschooling. My younger kids, so I've got a 5-year-old and 8-year-old, and they just go to regular public school, right? And, so why not homeschool them? Well, first of all, they're happy in regular school right now. So step one, if they're happy where they are, then, all right, it's not that bad for them to be there. At least they're not miserable in the morning. And secondly, their behavior is still too poor for me to actually homeschool. So my older kids, I just take to my office with me every day, and they do their work, and it's fine. My younger kids, I couldn't do my job and homeschool them at the same time. So that's the other thing. So I do want to leave that open as an option for my other kids. Homeschooling, is barely mentioned in the book. It's mentioned in the dedication, but otherwise, I don't talk about it very much. But it's the kind of thing that is a great option for some people. And if you are worried that you're sending a negative signal, it's very reasonable to worry about that. I will say I'm still concerned about that. That's why, for example, I'm still having my kids take a foreign language at my university, because I'm really worried about colleges saying they don't have a foreign language, then they're not worthy of being here. I don't think you can homeschool all the way through college. that would save a lot of money, but I don't think that would be safe for my kids' future. So that's what we're doing with them. I always do try to go and convince my kids that there's a lot of really interesting things that they might be able to learn in school. But at the same time, I know, if you push it too hard, then, the kids may say, oh, well, if you push it that hard, then it's probably not true. So I'm also known as the parent who, if I'm eating something, it probably tastes good, because I never lie about it, and I like to eat tasty food. Whereas my wife tells them it tastes good, maybe it doesn't really taste good. So I always try to maintain my reputation for reliability among all my kids, so that when I say it, they'll say, all right, Dad said it, right, true, right? Not just sugarcoating to get me to do what he wants.
Professor, how would you analyze college grade inflation?
Great question. So grade inflation, so it is true that grades have been going up over time. And from a signaling point of view, this is a little bit odd, because you might think the colleges would be very concerned to maintain their reputation for having high standards. So you might think there'd be a lot of pressure on them on administrators to keep professors from having too much grade inflation. Now, in practice, I can tell you, how many times has anyone at my university ever told me, Brian, either you're grading too easily, or Brian, good job, your grades are at the right level, or Brian, your grades are too hard? And the answer, in 20 years of teaching, no one has ever told me that what I'm doing is good or bad or indifferent, right? And this is totally normal. So a lot of this is that people think of professors, we're like artists, you can't tell us what to do. Whatever we think is a good idea, that is by definition a good idea. So, as to why it works this way, I have to think a lot of this is because of the nonprofit status of almost all universities, public or private, where there's just very little effort to control quality. And really, they're like worker co-ops, where as long as the other professors in your department are happy with you, that's good enough. I mean, you know, I agree that it's kind of weird on almost any story. Like, why you know, why is it that universities don't do more about it? Again, you know, like the only story that might that you know that at least would make will make some sense to say, well, look, here's the good thing about great inflation: if you get enough, employers really know not to hire you. If you get an F today, employers say, "My God, he got an F in today's grading system. This kid is toxic. No way." All right, so you might say that great inflation allows us to better identify really bad students. But yeah, I don't think that's true. I think it's mostly just that the inmates are running the asylum and professors can do whatever they want, and it's easier for professors to be easy graders. And then why aren't they giving everybody A's? The best thing I can tell, it is just professional pride. They're like, there is some point where a professor will say, my conscience does not allow me to give you an A for writing three words in crayon. It's just not acceptable. Right, so there are some limits to what professors can feel like in good conscience they can do, even though, of course, they're like, you know, you have to push them pretty far before they reach those limits. Yes, of course, there's some great professors. Yeah. Me, I'm great. Right.
Thank you. What would your advice be for families that are considering online education, K through 12?
Yes. Yeah, so for K through, you know, so for the K through 12 part. There, I think the main issue is just how will colleges view it, and I would say I say that right now I think there's still quite a bit of doubt about how seriously colleges will take it. Once it becomes very common, then there's safety in numbers, and then you can probably get away with it. I would hesitate to be an early adopter, right? So that's the way once you understand how hierarchical and rigid the system is. You don't want to, I never want to be the first person to do something weird. You're just worried that your kid is going to get punished because you were open-minded and open and willing to try something new. In terms of the actual amount that the kids learn, there's been some good research on this, and it seems like online education is at least as good as regular education just for learning. Right? So they will actually walk away with at least as much knowledge as kids in regular school. Of course, when you know how little that is, that's kind of disappointing. You'd hope that they could do better than that. It's the kind of thing that I would very much suggest watching. Now, the people in my world mostly talk about online college. And that, I will say, that probably you get a little bit more credit for employers for that than doing nothing. But I've seen no sign that employers take it seriously yet, and I would be very nervous about trying to skip college and doing it online. Although, again, if all you want to do is just learn a subject, then it's great. And, the truth is that, professors on Khan Academy are way better than the professors you're likely to actually get if you pay your own money. Right, so the people that do online education, they're normally some of the best pedagogues in the world, right? And they really care about teaching, and they may even go and study research, like how can teaching be improved, right? So, online education, wait and see. I know there are some people who are really hopeful that it is going to bring the whole higher education system crashing down, just like say Napster did to the record industry. I'm not worried about that at all. Right, so I think that's a very fanciful prediction. And, I had a colleague who actually 10 years ago started getting nervous about competition from online and saying, oh, we may be put out of work, Brian. And I just said, well, Alex, when your son is ready to go to college and he comes to you and says, hey, Dad, I want to go to an online college, what are you going to say? And my friend got some fire in his eyes, like, no son of mine's going to go there. Exactly, right? And since there's a whole lot of other parents just like you, so we're not going to be put out of business, so relax. And 10 years later, we're still in business.
Admittedly, Professor Kaplan, I've never read any of your books. However, I'm familiar with some of your work on EconLog. Mm-hmm. Your work was paraphrased in an article published on an online site, America.org, today. If you'll indulge me for a moment, Kaplan takes the Vedder paradox a step further. He actually argues that is individually advantageous for smart and ambitious people to deliberately unbalance their society. 25% of college attendees get personal benefits while only 5% of them do a whole lot of good for society. In other words, using cognitive separation to get a set of credentials empowers a lot of people without reference to whether it helps society. Mm-hmm. It allows these chosen few to compete for a set of jobs a lot of people could do, but a limited minority get to try out for. This mathematically almost has to make America a worse place. Anything that winnows the talent pool from which excellence is selected will cause there to be equal or less excellence. So, firstly, if you'd like to address that characterization of your work, and then secondly, if you could address, if you could articulate how biological realism relates to, your work, as in the differences of intelligence between human beings, almost in an ontological sense?
Okay. Sure. So I'd say that's a pretty fair description of what I'm saying. The main thing I disagree with is I don't think that educated people are sitting around cackling with glee and saying, ha, we've frozen all the other people out. We've captured all this great stuff for ourselves. You know, I think that most people with a lot of education, they really do sincerely think of it as something that's great for society. And, you know, they think, look, if we could all just stand up, we could all see better the concert. At the same time, they are aware of all the signaling element, but it's just hard for people to piece it together. And if you don't go and put a lot of thought into it, then I think it's very easy to have inconsistent views. On the one hand, to think, sure, most of what I learned in school is useless. Well, duh. And yet, also, it'd be great if everybody did all this useless stuff. I'm like, well, wait a second. How can those both be true? Again, so I don't think that it's any kind of a conscious plot. I think it's more of something that's done by neglect. You could call it callous to go and advocate policies without really, really thinking about it very much. In terms of biological realism, it's not actually important for my book one way or the other. Although I can see why people who think that genes are important would like the book a bit more, just because they're more open to the idea. Well, maybe some people just are less smart and they're just not going to get very much out of it. In other words, if you think about intelligence as purely something that's shaped by your environment, then you're probably going to be more optimistic about what school does. Whereas you think that the school might marginally change your intelligence, but it's not going to have a big effect, then again, I think that would tip things the other way. But I'd say that that's not really central to the arguments. It's something where it's a little bit easier to buy my story if you take biology more seriously. And yeah, so my last book was very heavily about biology. So I do think that's true. But in general, I try to not make any more controversial claims than I need to make the one that I'm making at any point in time. But yeah.
Isn't college the place where you meet the people who will buy your products, where you can meet the other successful people who therefore will buy your products? It's my father was a good salesman. College was how he made it, and I didn't do that well.
that is a great question. Yeah. So again, there's been a lot of research on this especially how important are contacts when you're getting a job? How important are they for success? And the answer is, for a very narrow range of occupations and majors, contacts are really important. So for example, if you want to go and work in Silicon Valley, Stanford, CES, awesome place to go. There you're not just learning programming, you're also making connections. You're meeting future customers, employees, partners. However, this is a small minority what's going on, and most people actually will never interact with their fellow students again. Here's the reason. The modern economy is so diverse, so vast, that the odds that you're ever going to encounter someone that you met in your English class again, like astronomically small, because most majors do not steer you into any specific jobs. So, if it's a very vocational major, then maybe. Right, so if it's CS or engineering, then maybe. Or, of course, me, if what you're going to do is become an academic. So I met people that helped me when I was in college because I wanted their jobs. So, yeah. But for most people actually are not going to get very little value out of the social contacts they make in school because the people that they know aren't actually in a position to ever help them. Now, it is true who you know is really important. But you're much better off having a close relative who loves you and wants to help you already at a firm than you are than having a bunch of classmates around. So the kinds of people that are useful, either you want to have someone that works in your exact industry, very closely tied in, or you want to have someone who loves you, right? But just sort of having an old friend from college who works in the paper industry, if you don't want to work in the paper industry, probably not going to be of much use to you.
You've spoken passionately about America opening its borders. I'm wondering how the student from the developing world will fit into the context of your most recent book.
Yeah, all right. So skipping ahead to the subject of my next book, All Roads Lead to Open Borders. Great chance to tie together two totally controversial things. As you might guess, the average education level in the United States is much higher than most of the world. Right now, again, if you thought of the main thing that education is doing is just building skills, you might then conclude that people in other countries are just very low skilled. On the other hand, if you buy my story, then you realize, someone could be a high school dropout in Mexico, and yet they could be awesome. right? Just because education levels are a lot lower in Mexico. So in a country where far fewer people do it, they might actually be very good. All right, now when immigrants come here, they generally do a bit worse in the labor market than you expect given their credentials. So part of this is probably just that they're struggling to learn the language, especially if they're coming later. And again, part of it may be that employers are not using the signals to the in that finely honed of a way. So again, like in principle, if you know that someone comes from a country where hardly anyone goes to college, then it would make sense to give them an extra chance as an employee. But again, if you don't know all the details of that, then you might say, it's too complicated, I'm not going to worry about it very much. So I guess how important it is. I guess just the main thing to know is that you should not assume that someone who's a high school dropout from Pakistan is going to have the same economic performance as someone who's a high school dropout in the U.S. Probably they're actually a lot more likely to be successful because the number of people that finish high school in Pakistan is a lot less. So really, it is less revealing of you and your potential.
Thank you, Professor, for taking my question. I'm curious, I've gotten the feeling from your talk that identifying signaling and the different guises that it takes through our higher educational system is kind of akin to pulling the veil away from the wizard seeing it for what it is. And yet you've also expressed what sounds like a very legitimate concern that since your children are being homeschooled, that college applicant processes might not take them as seriously. How does that kind of reconcile?
Right. So first of all, on the Wizard of Oz question, I was shocked twice on this because first, when Princeton told me I needed to get MGM's permission to go and quote the Wizard of Oz, and secondly, when they said yes, I was really, oh my God, like. There's someone whose job it is just to give professors free rights to quote the Wizard of Oz. But anyway, let's see. So why am I not worried about homeschooling my kids if I'm right? The answer is I started off, I was super worried because like, my God, like my kids are so miserable and like homeschooling, I think they'd be a lot happier, but this might mess up all their careers. And that's why I went and put a lot of effort into seeing, well, how do colleges currently treat homeschoolers? 30 years ago, I think they got treated very poorly. Right, and you'd have to be like five times as good to be treated half as well. But now, I did look around, and it does seem like things have changed a lot. And when I talked to very independent, neutral people with no axe to grind, they generally said, I don't think that the discrimination against homeschoolers is any worse than mild. And then I was thinking, well, so if it's mild holding their performance constant, if we can actually do much better things when we're homeschooled, and we can really wow people by what we can accomplish, then we can overcome that discrimination against homeschoolers. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I was very concerned. I'm still a bit concerned. And, I made phone calls to admissions officers at schools and started saying, so how do you treat homeschoolers here? Right? And, of course, there's a party line, oh, we treat them just the same as everybody else. And since I had them on the phone, like, yeah, but what do you really do? Come on, tell me. And yeah, very hard to get people over the phone to go and level with you. I've been trying to just go and talk to people face to face if I can, and say, all right, since it's not the phone, I'm not recording the conversation, just tell me what you really think. But it does, it seems to me like the best estimate on which I am willing to bet my kids' future is that the discrimination against homeschoolers just isn't that bad anymore. Right, and in particular, my thinking is this. Well, look, if you go and do something weird, it shows that you're weird. But if your parents do something weird, it also shows your parents are weird. Right, and homeschooling for K-12 is showing your parents are weird. Right, so in that case, well, we can be open-minded about that. But I'm not going to try to homeschool them for college. Right, and when people said, "Will you still send them to college?" Like, of course. Like unless there's a dramatic change in the way that the economy works in the next few years. Absolutely, I'm going to send them to college, right? In fact, I'm probably going to try to send them to one of the very top places and really game the system, right? So, and yes, and I tell my kids, yes, it's important to learn to game the system, right? Just because the system's fair doesn't mean you can just say I'm not going to try.
I don't think you actually answered his question. His question was, how do you reconcile your book, your views on signaling, with your contradictory behavior? I wouldn't call it hypocritical, but it's contradictory.
Hmm. Well, what I say is that regular schooling sends a signal, homeschooling sends a signal. So if the homeschooling signal is interpreted unfavorably, then you're going to get punished. On the other hand, if, as now, the average kid that's applying to college who's homeschooled actually is about as good as the average kid who did regular education, then I don't see the problem. There is a potential conflict, namely if there was in fact a lot of stigma against homeschooled kids. But it seems like there no longer is so much of a stigma. As long as homeschooled kids are, in fact, on average, good employees, then why is it that the world would hold against them? So I don't see the problem. All right, thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.